I always wear my mask and wash my hands after going home.
It's a good tuna, but I think I paid too much.
I am the king of the ring.
Yes, we are all kings of the rings. Welcome to the Japan What Podcast, episode 142. I am your host, MatthewPMBigelow.com. This is the podcast from the Tomihisacho Studios in Shinjuku, Tokyo, Japan. The armpit of Asia. Covering AI markets in Japan, the rising conflict in the Indo-Pacific, the supply chain wars, odd items, and more. We welcome you to the podcast. Thank you for joining us today. We're very busy people today. I always say busy bees. I don't know why I always, hey, we're busy bees. Are we bees? I'm not sure. Does that sound condescending? Like a teacher talking to adults like their students? Okay, everybody, it's time to start. So let's be quiet. Sometimes I see those people on weird videos on like on Twitter. Some parent-teacher conference where all the parents show up pissed off because there's like weird books that the teachers are teaching, and the parents are like, what is this book? What is this? What are you showing them? Okay, parents, we understand now. Please be quiet. We haven't started yet. My prediction is that they're not going to reach a consensus. But this is the Japan What Podcast. So thank you for joining us today. We're going to begin, as we always do, with a look at odd items because it indicates what's going on in the Japanese market. Is it good? Is it positive? Is it weird? Or is it like everywhere else, but more so?
Is it
everywhere else?
Oh, is it?
But more so. We have to do this. It's beyond ridiculous, and we have to do this. We'll be posting pictures of this up to MatthewPMBigelow.com. Want to spruce up your bike helmet? Switch over to Oshareheru. In recent years, the Japanese government has been pushing for all cyclists to wear helmets when biking, following last year's helmet shortage. Yeah, that was really tough on all of us. There are now many different kinds of looks for helmets that suit any age or gender. All 940 billion genders. If you're a Jir or a Gem, there is a helmet for you. One standout is Oshareheru, a customizable helmet that allows you to add attachments to the hat. Developed by brand Kojito, the Oshareheru is a helmet made for adults that comes in a variety of colors. It's easily adjustable and comes with removable padding to keep it clean. Beyond just the basic functionality of a helmet, Oshareheru aims to not only help you be safe, but also to have you look good. For rainy days, there's a water-resistant rain hat attachment that comes with reflective tape on both sides. When it's sunny out, why not don a straw-like UV hat attachment? If you're after more feminine silhouette, the crochet attachment was made to enhance your natural face line. Switching from one attachment to another can be done in three simple steps. The helmet itself is 6,380 yen, while each different attachments are 3,850 yen each. PR times. I'll be posting a picture of the Oshareheru at MatthewPMBigelow.com. Now, when you think about bike helmets, most of the world, people like ride mountain bikes or road bikes or like crazy cool bikes. And it kind of makes sense to like have like, hey, I'm Mr. Aerodynamic on my bike here. But most people in Japan ride what are called that mamachari. And these are like Dutch bikes from 100 years ago with a basket on the front. And they don't go very fast. So to kind of dress up like a super fast mountain biker, like you know, like, I'm going to go tear up some paths. Doesn't make much sense. So that's why we have the Oshare helmet. You wear your regular clothes, but you have like a hat on instead of a racer's helmet on. What do you think? Is it fashionable or is it simply matarded?
Is it? Oh, is it?
Oh, that way of saying that word is not going to get me out of any punishment. Recently, my son was being rude to my daughter. He was like, said, ikinasai, like, get out of here, something like that. And I said, don't say that to her. So he looked at me and he said, ikinasai. I was like, you just didn't say the E at the end of that. So I had to separate them, but I didn't say it. Oh, really? Okay. All right. Let's begin the podcast in earnest here, as they like to say in many of our things here. We're going to take a look at a couple of Japanese business things first before we move on to some other meaty articles.
Here we go.
This is a very short article, but it kind of it's indicative of the poison that's running rampant in our societies. And that poison, for me, is very much the World Economic Forum, and how you have all these people that go to these World Economic Forum events, and then they pose in pictures, and then those pictures get published onto AP and Reuters, and it's like, hey, here's an economist at the World Economic Forum. And but really, it's a death cult, and not a lot of people have woken up to this yet, but maybe this will help us, because this person who's associated with the WEF is kind of a death cultist. Economist who advocated mass suicide pulled from Kirin ad. Kirin Brewery Co. announced on March 13th that it had removed an online advertisement that debuted earlier this month featuring economist Yusuke Narita due to his past extreme remarks. No, he didn't say that two men can't have a baby. He said that the elderly should commit mass suicide while discussing the issue of Japan's declining birth rate and aging population in an online video program in 2021. Quote, we determined that his comments had overly extreme expressions, Kirin Brewery said. The company's decision to feature him in an ad for Kirin Hyoketsu Sugar-Free, a canned chew-high alcoholic beverage, led to calls for a boycott on social media. Yeah, I can drink, but you go die. After sincerely considering the feedback we received, we decided to withdraw the ad. Kirin Brewery said it chose Narita because, quote, we wanted him to convey the appeal of Kirin Hyoketsu, which leads the sugar-free chew-high trend, in his own words, to spark interest in a wide range of people. Not the elderly, it seems. So we have this WEF guy. What's his name? Yusuke Narita with the WEF. And of course, the WEF is just like, why don't you all just die so we can have everything? That's kind of what they do at the WEF. But it doesn't come out that way, because most people are like, oh, the World Economic Forum. Oh, it's not that weird death cult place. It's actually a very reasonable and good thing and blah, blah, blah. But I'm linking on his World Economic Forum page right here. He's an economist, a social entrepreneur, and public speaker writer working across multiple countries and fields. He's an assistant professor at Yale University in the U.S. and the founder of the startup Hanjuku Kaso Inc. in Japan. As a researcher, he develops methods that use algorithm, data, and evidence to improve social decision-making, like mass suicide. What a dick. At the intersection of academia, industry, media, and policy, his work has won several prizes, including the Prime Minister Prize, the Japanese government's Open Innovation Award, MIT Technology Review's Innovators Under 35 Japan, and KDDI Contribution Award, among others. He obtained a PhD from MIT and a bachelor from the University of Tokyo. Todai is a captured institute. That place is creepy. He was previously a visiting associate professor at Hitotsubashi University and blah, blah, blah. So anyways, he has an amazing, amazing pedigree, and his curricula vitae makes him seem like a perfect person to promote cheap chuhai to the elderly. But he also says they should all die. And that's his economic policy. I'm looking at the data using algorithms, and because I'm part of the World Economic Forum, it's just easier to just say, go die. That's our policy here at the World Economic Forum. You die. Can I have an advertisement, please? I want to sell cheap Chuhai. What? Weird. Next, we're going to take a look at the pay gap. Now, this is a very interesting idea here. Now, there's two echelons. We can just say two echelons for the convenience of the podcast of Japanese companies. There's the seniority based echelon of the dinosaur companies, like most news media organizations and so on that don't need to innovate. And they're based on males getting older and automatically getting promoted. And not to say that there's no merit there, because the ones that are older and more meritable or meritocracy find the better positions in those companies. But how can you have a company that has middle management and management and upper management of 95% men in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s with the CEO potentially in his 80s or 90s suddenly say, we now want all the women to join us? Well, there's just not enough space in the corporate structure to make that happen. But there's also, because of the internet, a lot of newer companies coming along. And one of them is called Mercari. And Mercari is, I talked about Mercari on the last pod, a couple of podcasts before, sorry, about their adoption of BTC for payments and things like that. It's an online marketplace. And they have a very youthful approach. And they're still a new enough company where their structure isn't filled up with ideas of the past. And I'm not necessarily against having a male-dominated workplace if it's just that's the way it is. And for most of the world, that is the way it is. And we can change as the time changes organically and things like that. But you can't take a Japanese company that is filled with 40, 50, 60, 70-year-old men and just overnight change it to 50% women and then DEI inclusion and all that. It can happen naturally in the burgeoning stages of a company and things like that. And if that's what happens, then the company can probably learn to succeed within those parameters. But you just can't take existing parameters and change them. That's not how reality operates. It'd be like saying, oh, I'm gonna change all my clothes to a different size, and then that's going to be great because that's just the sign of the times. It doesn't work that way. But Mercari does. And so this article from the Asahi Shimbun says, towards equality, Mercari official deciphers unexplained pay gap. In recent years, the unexplained pay gap, used to describe persistent disparities in compensation between men and women, which is often hijacked by activists because they don't take into account that like men do a lot of the dangerous work that pays more. You just can't compare a lot of these things. So yeah, men will make more, but they die earlier and so on. And maybe women are making less because they're newer in certain fields and they haven't climbed up in the ranks to gain that access to that money yet. But at the same time, I'm going to say that there's going to be a lot of industries with set parameters that don't allow for a lot of women to move up because of existing discriminatory patterns. I'm playing both fields here, and I don't care which side you're on. Mercari, which operates the leading flea market app, Mercari, announced in September 2023 that a data analysis had found an unexplained pay gap of about 7% among its employees, exceeding the globally permissible limits. It doesn't say where those limits are. That sounds like WEF shit to me. The e-commerce marketplace operator made the necessary pay adjustments, but it was baffled by the outcome after having worked to improve gender equality. So this is an interview with who? Akio Chuo, 45, manager of the diversity and inclusion team at Merucari's management strategy office, led the analysis. In an interview with the Asahi Shimbun, she said the study revealed factors that are unique to Japan, where there's a wide range gap in between compensation packages for men and women. So these are like excerpts from the interview, and I'm just going to find the one that I wanted to focus on that is more data-driven, rather than just interviewers blathering to each other. This is not an interview show, she said, Ms. Chuo, or whoever. When we reviewed possible scenarios, we came up with two promising hypotheses for the cases. First, there are a certain number of women who were recently promoted as part of our efforts to accelerate gender equality. One hypothesis is that immediately after their promotion, some of them were receiving wages lower than those of coworkers who were in the same pay grade. That may have influenced the outcome. All right, so they say, well, we need more women in our workforce. Well, if you get incremental pay raises every year, when you, even though you're in the same like category as someone else in an institution, if someone's there for 5 years and you're in there the first year, well, if the majority of men are in there now, there's a massive amount of women that are injected into that same category at that same time, there's going to be a disparity in the amount of people that are there based on seniority. All right. Over 90% of employees at Merucari are mid-career hires. When we offer annual salaries at the time of hiring, we determine the amount based on their salaries from their previous jobs. Engineers' salaries, however, are determined by a skills test, so there's virtually no unexplained pay gap for engineers. For non-engineers, it is quite difficult to estimate their pay grades, you know, based on where they are from. But from July last year, we started offering annual salaries to non-engineers without taking their previous salaries into consideration. We have already started restricting information on their previous salaries to the human resources level and are letting the top member of each department that is hiring new recruits determine their salaries. We were nervous to do this because many of those we will want to hire will have already received many job offers from other companies, meaning that we might not be able to recruit them if we offer lower salaries or are less competitive in the job market. We are working to increase our abilities to estimate a candidate's worth through interviews alone and through discussions with frontline recruiters. The fact that such a pay gap exists even at Merucari, where 90% or more of its employees are mid-career and were hired using their previous salaries as reference, shows our society is plagued with pay gaps. When I think of how labor mobility will become increasingly common, we must end the cycle of pay gaps. I don't think that what we do is the only solution, but we hope that sharing our efforts as much as possible will help redress the society gap in society as a whole. And it kind of ends there. I'm not reading the whole thing, obviously, but it'll be linked up at MatthewPMBigelow.com if you want to see it. Now, what I like about this, well, there's a couple of things, is that I'm not sure. HR can have a little bit too much power in a lot of departments these days. And if you're hiring a bunch of engineers, well, they need to be just, they need to interface with the technology on an engineering capability. So it's kind of easy to see what that value is. But when you have a whole bunch of HR people or sales people, it becomes less easy to understand what's kind of going on. I guess in Merucari, they don't need the sales as much. But they were looking at hiring people based on their previous experiences, and maybe those people coming from other companies, those companies had biases in them. So in a way, Merucari was importing those biases into its own company based on the data it was receiving from the pay gap that was inherent in those companies from before. And it's kind of interesting that they're looking to eliminate the pay gap. But you know, if you're a mid-career person and I'm person A and you're person B, and we're mid-career people getting into a company like Merucari, you're probably not like super successful. Like, to be honest, you're reasonably successful. So there probably should be an even wage distribution at that level when you're coming into a company at that stage. So it's interesting that they're using these approaches to try to minimize the pay gap between men and women. I've never been in this real situation before. I've never really competed on the corporate level on this. So I'm not really privy or even a part of this mass segment of society. I've always been, there's a salary and I take it or I leave it. And within my industry, there really isn't a pay gap that I was involved in. So Depending on your previous experience, you might get rewarded more based on the amount of work you're willing to do. And if you're a young single man in your mid-20s and you're looking to pay off student loans, you're probably willing to work a lot more than somebody who's in their 40s who's already paid off all their loans and is now looking to take it easy a little bit. So the amount of overtime might offset and create like a pay gap disparity, but that's only because one person is technically working more hours than another person. So there's that as well. So I thought that was kind of interesting to look at for today. There's this, who wants a pay gap? When we look at it from direct job to direct job, notice that they're not saying that like, hey, we want our school teachers to be paid the same as our astronauts. Like it's not some communist evaluation. It's based on skills and it's based on biases and they're looking to eliminate some biases through data. I thought that was very interesting and worth noting that not everybody who is involved in this type of thing is some sort of rabid ideologue foaming at the mouth and some sort of hater. And that's going to be the Japan Society for today.
Here we go.
I meant Japan economy. Sorry. I was looking at the next one. We're going to take a look next at Japan Society 5.0.
The fourth industrial revolution will enable us to create a new society. Artificial intelligence will transform the big data collected through the Internet of Things into new wisdom. Society 5.0. A technology-based, human-centered society. The industrial revolution will raise our standard of living and solve various challenges we face. It will, for example, free us from the stress of driving, allowing us to safely visit anyone, anytime.
All right, that's of course the Japanese government's promotion for their vision of Japan Society 5.0, moving into an AI society. From Japan Society 1.0, which was hunter-gatherer, and the list goes up, or the capabilities go up. Of course, that was made in 2016-2017, back when I was an AI teacher and researcher at a Japanese telecoms, and since then I've been keeping up with Japan Society 5.0 because it's an umbrella term for how the Japanese elites want to transform the society into a new society. And it's like, well, I should probably be interested in that. If I'm here and that's what they want to do, I should be interested in that. So I cover it. I'm the only one who covers it. I'm the only one who cares. This one comes to us. Well, what I mean to say is that now that we are in 5, 6, 7 years later, the AI market has exploded, but it hasn't exploded with drone delivery. That drones are now a warfare weapon. Now, most of the delivery systems for drones are promoted via things that go boom, boom into humans' faces or onto infrastructure. not getting your stuff from Amazon or whatever. You don't get your diapers delivered by drone. Imagine how cool that would be. Here are your shit tickets. You're like, thank you, drone. And it goes away. I really wish that was the society we were living in, to be honest. But nope, can't have that. Now it's LLMs. Now it's election hacking. Now it's like mysterious AI that needs to have guardrails imposed on it by the EU and things like that. But we're taking a quick look from another interview here by the Mainichi, Japan's national daily since 1922. This was recorded on March 18th, 2024. Not this podcast. We're doing this towards the end of March here. But this is Japan Prof probes strengths and weaknesses of rapidly evolving AI translation interview. 10 years ago, if you were a professor who was saying, we're going to use AI for translation, you'd be run out of town. Now it's completely normalized and nobody even bats an eye to it. That's how quickly this is moving here. And he says, he responds to these questions, just how widespread is AI in the field of translation? Well, you can imagine it's very high. this is a Japanese professor, so it's like the question is, how do you view the capabilities of AI translation? And his answer is, recently I translated an English version of a picture book created by a Ukrainian author into Japanese. In the case of indirect translation, probably meaning in Ukrainian to English to Japanese, which is what this person probably was doing, I always ask a specialist to check the translation against the original. But since there was no one around who could speak Ukrainian, an acquaintance used translation software to translate the Ukrainian original into English, and the result was almost the same as the English translation. I found that it is possible to translate between European languages with a quite high degree of accuracy. Translations between European languages and those that use Chinese or Arabic characters, on the other hand, appear to be quite difficult. So I think those barriers will eventually become overcome. That's a good point. You really can't trust the kanji or the Chinese characters and the Japanese characters and the grammar and the nuance to be translated directly into another language, a European language especially. It's just 15% of the time there's going to be something weird in a sentence, and you'll be cruising along, and then it just gets crazy. It gets stupid weird. What are the weaknesses of AI? What will be the role of translators in the future? And his answer is, when AI becomes able to translate foreign language novels into natural Japanese without errors, the work of translators will disappear. But that's so far away, we don't really need to worry about it. This is B. If there is a path for translators to survive in such an age, we would have to do something about it. They say, what is the significance of learning foreign languages in the AI age? And he says, English was originally an elective subject under Japanese compulsory education system, but it was made mandatory. As a result, teachers are sometimes criticized when students are unable to speak, read, and write well enough after studying English for 6 years in junior high and high school. If AI translation becomes widespread, I get the feeling we will return to the approach of foreign language education of days gone by, which focused on learning about different cultures through language and deepening mutual understanding, rather than learning English as a mere tool, then I think it will no longer be necessary to specialize in English as a language to study. I kind of disagree with him, but I think what he's saying is, instead of just trying to be like technical English people that pass tests, they will be able to speak English to each other as a language for communication. And that's an interesting idea, because most Japanese people are actually quite good at English. They're good at reading English. They're good at typing. They're good at their English ability is quite high, except for speaking, where it totally blows. Most people in Japan speak very little English. And maybe that will increase, is what he's saying. So in the world of Japanese translation, this professor says that it's becoming better and better for use of translating books. But it's not still quite at the level where it translates literature. Let's take a look at the next one. AI supercharges threat of disinformation in big year for elections globally. I'm not going to go into this very much, but it ties into what I want to cover in the next item, so I'll come back to it. New AI tools can record your medical appointment or draft a message for your doctor. Now, one thing that we're looking at, especially in the last couple of weeks here, is the increased usage of AI in the medical fields, and that can be with facial recognition, it can be with notation, it can be with analysis of your medical imaging systems and things like that. But anyways, it's blowing up, because medical language is highly regulated, so there's not going to be a lot of differentiation between systems. That's the main thing that AI doesn't handle well, is differentiation between systems. So if nothing is differentiated, the data model becomes more accurate once it gets larger and larger and larger. This comes to us from New York, but these are also applicable to things in Japan. Is my doctor using AI? In recent years, medical devices with machine learning have been doing things like reading mammograms, diagnosing eye disease, and detecting heart problems. This is done digitally, so it can identify digital patterns on a computer screen, the AI, and identify illnesses at a very early stage that most people might skip over. This is very crucial for AI diagnoses. What's new is generative AI's ability to respond to complex instructions by predicting language. Your next checkup could be recorded. That's why I chose this. The use of your in this article, it's like, it's so normalizing it. Your checkup, your next checkup could be recorded by an AI powered by a smartphone app that listens, documents, and instantly organizes everything into a note you can read later. Doesn't this sound horrifying? What? My phone is doing this? Why is my phone, why is my personal device the thing that's doing this? This should be the hospital's technology that is limited to use inside the hospital that's doing this. You might be able to send some PDFs or whatever to my phone later, but it should not be my phone that's doing all of this. The tool can also mean more money for the doctor's employer because it won't forget details that legitimately could be billed to insurance. Your doctor could ask for your consent before using the tool. Other AI tools could be helping your doctor draft a message, but you might not know it. Doctors or nurses must approve the AI-generated messages before sending them. In one Colorado health system, such messages contain a sentence disclosing they were automatically generated, but doctors can delete that line. That's not good. Will AI mistakes? What about the human touch? It goes on from there. What about privacy? It's like, well, it's noted at the end there, so who cares? It was taken from JapanToday.com. That's why I'm kind of including it in today. Many countries have different very values when it comes to this type of thing, AI and medical and security and things like that. But I really don't believe that my device should be the thing that's doing the medical stuff in a hospital. Like, that's why we're paying the doctors. That's why we have the hospital. It should not be the patient's side. It should totally be the hospital side. Otherwise, it's like an idiocracy moment where the doctor just looks at it and he goes like, yeah, you talk like a fag and your shit's all retarded. And then your phone says, oh, you need pills. Go to the pharmacy and we will get your pills there. Not good. Not good. It just takes all the specialty that's supposed to be concentrated at an established building, i.e. hospital, and just deletes all of that, puts it into your phone, and then they just say whatever, and then the phone tells you what to do. Whoa. That's their vision. And it's like, hey, when you go, you will use your phone and your phone will do this for you. I don't think so. I think that's a nightmare. And the last one is AI supercharges threat of disinformation in a big year for elections globally. We just had the Russian election. Putin got back in. We have a major election in America right now. And it looks like Japan will also probably move towards some major elections as well. And in 2016, when Trump won the U.S. election, not to mention it, but it's just like a focal point. One of the major points that was used at the time was media. A lot of doctors and celebrities saying, oh, if Trump wins, we're going to move to Canada and so on. Now, I think the next wave is going to be AI, focusing content, AI finding content that will typically psychographically motivate people to vote one way or the other. And we're going to see this worldwide. How the extent that it will happen in Japan might be pretty limited. The voting block in Japan tends to be quite older, and most of the politicians can't really say much by law or decree. That's why you have like the typical politician in Japan wearing a white glove, waving at the side of a building with their name on the side, waving at the side of a car, moving car on the road with their name written on the side. And you might be able to go see their platforms and so on. But it's going to be interesting to see how AI is going to be used as the legacy media falls apart. And it is falling apart right now. I view it as zombie media. And Hollywood doesn't have an iota of influence in the world compared to even 10, 15 years ago. I don't watch movies anymore. I don't care about movies anymore. I have a minor degree in film from university. I just was enthralled with the culture of film. And then when it became all streamed from Netflix and everything like that, the technology changed and then everything else changed. So I bailed. I got out. But the thing is that those used to have, be major concentrations of political soft power, and now it's all gone. But as the rise of AI comes up, the entertainment industry is going to move into that, try to use that as a form of soft power worldwide to influence people's minds and hearts and blah, blah, blah for elections. And it's going to be interesting to see how it's going to be used in Japan. It has been used against Prime Minister Kishida in the past. It makes very, very bad videos. It was just satire, more or less. But it created a ripple effect where people kind of went, whoa, we got to be very careful with this stuff in Japan because we don't want to use it to trick people into voting one way or another. So it's going to be interesting. Like I said, there's no real clear examples at the moment that I could find. But what I want to think about is as this year moves on and these elections move on, to monitor how AI is being used in the political space, because the politicians have really involved themselves in AI over the past few years as a way to create guardrails, as to create ways to incorporate it into their own systems and so on. So they've entered into this field, into this ocean, into this pond, and it'll be interesting to see how that pond treats them in return. That's Japan Society 5.0 for today.
The fourth industrial revolution will enable us to create a new society. Artificial intelligence will transform the big data collected through the Internet of Things into new wisdom.
War. Supply chains. The supply chain war.
Die for the war. Everybody moves. Die for the good. For the good. Die for the war. Die for the war.
All right, so I believe we're in a supply chain war. I've mentioned this before, but if you take a look at the past 4 or 5 years, China is making very strong tailwinds into securing more and more of the global supply chain route with its One Belt and One Road policy, as discussed on the last podcast. But one thing that we also need to consider is that the digitization of the supply chain networks with IoT and AI on the ships themselves, on those giant ships, they want them to be self-driving ships. They want the IoTs to develop the Internet of Things to be implemented into these ships for monitoring not only the cargo, but the flow of water and wind around ships to determine if there are more viable routes nearby that a ship is using to reduce energy consumption on the ship and things like that. So there's an entire network thing, but that means it's vulnerable to hacking. This comes to us from 5 ways AI is helping to reduce supply chain attacks on DevOps teams. And again, sometimes for the Japan What podcast, like these things are going to affect Japan. Japan is a major shipper and importer and a major player in the global supply chain route. So even if it's not like domestically affecting some people in Mie or prefecture, the fact that there's these systems being put into a place will be affecting Japan and affecting people in Japan as a result of it. That's the way I believe it. So you can look internally or externally, but it's not like we're trying to figure out some local coral reef problem off the coast of Australia. Japan is playing a major role in the international supply chain routes, and we need to understand what's going on with that when it becomes more and more digitized. Where to go? Open up that link again. 5 ways AI is helping to reduce supply chain attacks on DevOps teams. I'm not going to go too much into this article just because, like, okay, it's not really about Japan, but a staggering 91% of enterprises have fallen victim to software supply chain incidents in just a year, underscoring the need for better safeguards for continuous integration and continuous development pipelines. 4 in 10 enterprises say misconfigured cloud services, stolen secrets from source code repositories, insecure use of APIs, and compromised user credentials are becoming common. I've had this experience as well, and where you're a new person and you go into a place and they have a system and it's pretty good, but you go and click on an action and it's like the action might be like go to A and go to B, and then the button A and B are like right next to each other, and then you might be looking, you click on it, and it, instead of clicking A, you accidentally click B and hit go. Well, if A and B were on the opposite sides of the screen, you wouldn't make that error. But if you're a new person and you're like, oh, I hit the wrong one. Well, it's already gone and now it's already sent. Now we can bring it back, but it's going to be costly. These types of things within cloud infrastructure and graphic user interfaces, I imagine they're insanely common. The most common impacts of these attacks are the malicious introduction of cryptojacking malware and the needed remediation steps of impacting SLAs, service level agreements. Among those enterprises that have experienced software supply chain incidents in the last 12 months, 96% suffered some impact. Attackers are using AI to fine-tune their tradecraft and launch attacks that outpace any organization's ability to keep up. While attackers use offensive AI working to their advantage, cybersecurity vendors need to step up the challenge and go all in on AI to gain a greater defense strategy and not lose the AI war. And I think Japan needs to hire a bunch of gray hats from around the world, because as Japan plays a major role in not only shipbuilding, but in the shipping industry, they are very naive on average as to how a lot of criminal cyber gangs operate on an international level. They might be pretty savvy for domestic criminal organizations. That's kind of why I'm bringing this in. But the knowledge of international organizations and loopholes and ways to exploit code and things like that can be pretty low. Another company that brought in some Korean gray hat hackers, type hackers to cybersecurity officers or service providers into their networks was the app called Line. And they made an effort to kind of internationalize their cybersecurity a little bit. So why software supply chains are a high value target? 5 areas where AI is strengthening supply chain security. I'm not going to go too much into this because I'll just take a look at it here. Where does it begin? Let's take a look. Okay. The AI to automate hybrid and multi-cloud security while shifting security left in the SDLC. It's kind of hard to understand. AI continues to harden endpoint security down to the identity level while also defining the future by training LLMs. Adaptive automated threat detection. AI is streamlining and simplifying analytics and reporting across pipelines, identifying potential risks or roadblocks early and predicting attack patterns. That's probably the key one. Using AI and machine learning to automate patch management and so on. So if you're interested in this type of thing, and it'd be worth going to MatthewPMBigelow.com to take a look. A couple of other things here that we're going to look at is 4 firms plan ammonia-fueled ammonia carrier ship. Japan really loves the idea of using green technologies because it's part of the G7, and the part of the supply chain war is the China side, the BRIC side, using digital infrastructure and peer-to-peer payment systems to interact with each other economically on their own currencies and things like that, whereas the G7 tends to lean towards using the American petrodollar and relying on the American Navy as a security blanket for their international shipping centers. But one thing that the G7 is also obsessed with is with the green idea, where we can't use any carbon, like carbon neutral by 2050. Everything has to be no carbon. No carbon bad. Fossil fuels bad. Although, are they fossil fuels? We all know that they're regenerative hydrocarbons at this point. But anyways, 4 firms plan first ammonia-fueled ammonia carrier ship. A consortium of Japanese companies will set sail on domestically building an ammonia carrier ship that is fueled by ammonia, which emits no carbon dioxide when burned. The cleaner fuel source is part of an effort to decarbonize seafaring vessels, which are a major source of global CO2 emissions. The ship, scheduled for completion in 2026, is expected, following a demonstration voyage, to be the world's first vessel of its kind and to be used in international shipping. The plan was jointly released on January 25th by four companies, including shipping giant Nippon Yusen KK. Use of the ship, which co-fires ammonia with heavy fuel oil, can cut emissions of greenhouse gases by more than 80%. Safety, however, is the biggest challenge for the vessel, which will run on toxic ammonia. I mean, you don't want that blowing up. And it goes on from there. So that's one example of ammonia in Japan. And then the other one is to move away from the dangerous, dangerous CO2. And this comes to us from Nikkei Asia. As usual, their way of doing things over there. I don't particularly like the Nikkei. The Nikkei Asia is okay. No. The Japanese Nikkei is generally fine, but the Nikkei Asia is a globalist hellhole. Japan's JERA, IHI, to test ammonia as fuel at coal power plant. Japan proposes a way to keep Asia's coal power plants running in low carbon era. I think we're going to get into a high carbon era, to be honest. I don't see this low carbon thing panning out. A Japanese technology that aims to reduce carbon emissions from existing coal-fired power plants by substituting ammonia for a portion of the coal they burn will take a step closer to reality as testing begins at a commercial plant later this month. The country's largest power generator, JETA, an engineering company, IHI, are preparing for a world-first attempt to generate electricity by burning a mix of coal and ammonia at a coal power plant in Aichi Prefecture. A key benefit of the technology is its potential to supply cleaner power while still utilizing coal-fired plants. Tackling climate change requires that these plants be phased out, but doing so economically could take decades. Japan hopes its ammonia fuel technology will attract customers in developing Asian countries, which depend on newer coal plants than those in the West, to meet rising energy demand. Ammonia, which is used to make fertilizers or for industrial purposes at present, does not emit carbon when burned. And it goes on from there. I'll be linking it to MatthewPMigolo.com. But what about, so they want to export this technology to all these other countries. What if all these other countries just go with the Japanese Belt or the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative and they say, well, we don't really care about these stupid climate change. In fact, nobody really believes it except for really crazy people at the UN, and we're getting tired of it and we don't see the benefit of going along with it. We see the benefit of using cleaner sources and maybe ammonia as part of that, but some power plant in Laos expected to handle massive amounts of ammonia. We don't know how this is supposed to work out, but it's more examples of the supply chain war of the G7 going all green and assuming that the rest of the world is going to go along with it. Well, actually, the rest of the world is moving on and just continuing to amp up their use of regenerative hydrocarbons or coal and all of that. And I hope that they continue to develop cleaning facilities or ways to reduce the pollution from these things, because just putting ammonia and solar power plants and windmills in the air and saying, look, our economy is fine now, I think it's a suicide cult, and it's a way of dooming the future generations to poverty so that the current generation dies feeling better about themselves. That's it.
Die for the war, everybody moves. Die for the good, for the good. Die for the war, die for the war.
But I still hate pollution, and I want all that badness to not, go up. But we'll see. I think if China continues on its path, they're going to poison a lot of their own people with their lack of regulations. So there's that as well. I don't want to seem like I'm some sort of like, hey, all this is, I hate renewables. It's like, I don't, but we can't put all the eggs in that basket. It doesn't make any sense. Diversity of energy is also important. And that also includes regenerative hydrocarbons, what many people like to call fossil fuels, which is a fake term created by the oil industry to introduce the idea of scarcity into market prices, which eventually drives them up. But if you say regenerative hydrocarbons, well, that might drive down the prices and create more cheaper energy for us all. And it might also put a lot of those energies into the sustainable regenerative eco factor as well. Thank you. You found it. The Japan What Podcast, episode 142. I bid thee from the Tomihisa Cho Studios in Shinjuku, Tokyo, Japan, the orbit of Asia, a very heartful and warmful ja mata ne.